welcome to Restoring the Soul, a podcast dedicated to helping you close the gap between what you believe and what you actually experience. I'm your producer, Brian Beatty, in Cincinnati, and I'm here with my good friend, Michael John Cusick, in Denver, Colorado. Michael.
Hey, Brian. How are you?
I am well. I'm, as we are recording this, we are on the cusp of fall, and fall in Ohio is quite gorgeous. I just spent the last couple days in Kentucky in Red River Gorge, and the trail, it was only a mile long, but it was probably on a 45-degree angle the entire way. So it was humbling and yet beautiful at the same time. We are concluding a three-part series in the Accountability Matrix, talking about the three forms of healthy vulnerability. Episode number one was regarding cop accountability, and then coach accountability in podcast number two. And here we are in the third part. Michael, if you could talk about cardiologist accountability, the essence of it is to move from accountability to accessibility. Unpack that for us today.
That's right. So back to the analogy that I used in the first episode, and I talked about accountability in terms of paying my mortgage, that they send a bill and they say how much I owe and they tell me what my balance is on my mortgage and there are late fees. If I don't pay it on time, then I accrue those late fees. And if I continue not to pay it, I lose the home and I will not be able to live there. I'll become homeless. And so we're moving from that sense of an external sense of control and consequences and punishment to a form of internal control. And with that cheesy analogy of the mortgage, think about a person who would just every 3 or 4 days stop by the mortgage company and say, "Hey, how you doing, mortgage company employees? I have a mortgage with you, and 4 more days until I pay my mortgage. Would you mind if I actually paid it today?" And they'd say, "No, not at all. It's a little weird that you come by here all the time, but not at all." In other words, there's an initiative, there's a attentiveness, there is a strength, there is a diligence where paying the mortgage is not based on these consequences, punishments, and a fear of homelessness. It's the fact that the owner of the home wants to literally have the home as their own and be able to do whatever they want with it, whether that's to make a profit and flip the house or whether it's to paint it fluorescent yellow, but it's to inhabit the structure, right? So addiction of all kinds and compulsion keeps us from inhabiting our own lives. It keeps us from being present in our body. It keeps us from being present in the midst of whatever restlessness or anxiety is there. So, because all sexual compulsion and addiction, Brian, is a form of false intimacy, the goal of accountability is really accessibility. And accessibility, to use the house and the mortgage metaphor, is, hey, come on over, come to my house, come on in, put your feet up on the table. Can I get you a cold drink? Can I make you a snack? Do you want to play cards or checkers or watch TV or let's get our hiking boots and go for a hike? In other words, it's all about relationship and experiencing the other and about being known. In other words, true intimacy. So real accountability leads to accessibility, and that requires vulnerability. Vulnerability requires trust. Trust requires courage, and courage requires faith. And I could just see somebody right now going, "Ah, what's that? Back it up." But we'll unpack all of this in this conversation about cardiologist accountability.
Okay, Michael, so be concrete. Give me a definition of cardiologist accountability.
At its simplest, Brian, cardiologist accountability is an intentional relationship where the accountability partner is there to care for and promote the well-being, the thriving of a person's heart and soul, and I'm using heart and soul interchangeably, where COP accountability was about checking in and coach accountability is about building in, cardiologist accountability is about digging in. In Jeremiah, this passage is in Surfing for God. I unpack it, but the prophet Jeremiah says, "Men of Israel and Judah, break up the unplowed ground of your heart and circumcise your heart unto the Lord." And so this is about kind of taking out the spade together and saying, what's going on in your heart? And not just the sin or the depravity, but what are your longings? How are you aware of your longings? What do you do with your longings? How do you satisfy those deep thirsts in your heart? What's the pain in your heart? What do you do with that pain? What is it like to be you in relationship with the people that you know and love? And so the cardiologist accountability partner has a language of the heart or a language of the soul, which is about the inner life. And this person doesn't need to be a psychotherapist or a professional counselor or a spiritual director. This person just needs to have been on the journey themselves of stepping into this inner journey, this journey into one's own heart and soul. And when a person begins to do that, they begin to discover a language of the heart, a language that for many people feels foreign. I've had men say to me, you know, Michael, you're asking me about your heart. Around here and at our men's intensive weekends, we'll often greet men by saying, instead of, hey, how's it going? We'll say, how's your heart? And the first couple times we say that to someone, they're like looking around, you know, for a man with an oxygen tank or something, and they think we're asking about their cholesterol level. But how's your heart? I've heard men say, you know, it feels like you're speaking Cantonese to me when you ask that question. I have no idea how to respond. And so this language of the heart is sometimes seen and felt as we watch movies, whether they're rom-coms or whether they're an action thriller. The language of the heart, that when I watch a Jason Bourne movie, it may not be specific words, but there's something in me that wakes up that wants to fight bad guys. There's something in me that wants to have that adventure. There's something in me that wants to be that risky and dangerous and to be on a kind of mission. And that is speaking to my heart. And therefore, that movie is a language of the heart. Ted Lasso is a TV show that Julianne and I have been watching. And I know most of America is watching that show. And apart from all of the, you know, issues with language and sex in that show, the show is absolutely brilliant. And I have had men text me, email me, call me, friends, former clients saying, did you see this episode where blank, I won't do a spoiler for it, but these men are saying, I just lost it when I watched this scene between these two men and how this man stepped in for the other one, or how he was talking about how his father wounded him at a certain age. That is a language of the heart. And an analogy that I like to use sometimes, because somebody told me it was very helpful, as people do counseling, as people enter into recovery, there's a language of recovery that there's buzzwords and things like that that are oftentimes cliches, like one day at a time or easy does it or watch your stinking thinking, things like that. But then there's a language that goes deeper than that, and that's the language of the soul and the heart, which is a language of longing, a language that tends to, highlights, addresses, puts words to our longings for attention, affection, affirmation, acceptance, those core longings that we talk about in Surfing for God. And many people have said, I just can't speak this language. I either don't know what I feel or what I long for or what I think. And our daughter was adopted from China when she was a year old, and therefore her native tongue is Mandarin Chinese. And for a whole year, her nannies spoke to her in Mandarin. And when she came home, we could even say a couple words like ni hao and xie xie, and daddy was baba and brother was guga. And we'd say those words and she would kind of perk up. And today, except for probably thank you from a Chinese restaurant, she doesn't speak any Mandarin Chinese, but her native tongue is actually Mandarin Chinese. And in the same way, every human being, because we're made in God's image, our native language, our native tongue is this language of the heart and soul, which is a language of longing. It's a language of connection. It's a language of depth. It's a language that sometimes doesn't even require words, which is why one great theological mystic said that God's first language is silence. And that's why if there's a language of the heart, oftentimes stillness and solitude is what we have to begin to practice to get in touch with this language of the heart, where the sensations in our body and our emotions are what communicate to us as much as anything else. And as we begin to learn some of those words and phrases in this language of the heart, we can then bring that back into this accountability relationship to talk about what's happening inside of us.
So as it relates to cardiologist accountability, Michael, are there situations where this approach is most needed?
Yeah, absolutely. When a person has gone beyond disclosure and confessed or gone through a series of confessions or disclosures, and when they've really begun to engage in saying, I really do want to take action and begin to step into dealing with the roots of this and not just getting sober, but recovering and actually restoring my life, then they'll get to a point where they'll either just kind of spin their wheels and have some sobriety and then fall, have sobriety, fall, and have this repetition of relapses and then starting all over again. Or in some cases, for whatever reason, and we don't completely understand this, people will get some cop accountability and coach accountability, and they will stop the behavior. They'll be sober. Now, my experience has been that they're sober, but they're not free. And what that means is they've stopped the behavior, but they've not necessarily changed on the inside. In AA, we would call this a dry drunk. And a dry drunk is, as they say in Alcoholics Anonymous, you're still an ass, but you have less dents in your car. In other words, you're not crashing into foam poles in other cars, but you're still kind of unhealthy and not that much fun to be around. So when someone says, I want to change, I don't want to just stop my behavior. I want to learn how to be intimate. I want to learn how to be free of shame. I want to learn how to live as a beloved son or daughter, where I don't have to prove anything, where I don't have to hide anything. And the role of the cardiologist accountability partner is really like a person that tends to the soul, a soul shepherd, like Psalm 23. And this may be more for counselors and therapists and spiritual directors, but a soul surgeon. Now, granted, a person doesn't have to have that professional training to just sit and really listen. I have seen many, many men who are part of our leadership team at our Surfing for God weekend just have a profound presence of caring and knowing and holding space for people to struggle as they dig in together. And this, Brian, becomes a gospel of restoration, whereas the cop accountability is a gospel of sin management and the coach accountability is a gospel of inspiration. The gospel of restoration is that God is going to give you back and bring you back what was before there was ruin. You're going to get back your heart. You're going to get back your freedom. You're going to get back that sense of being naked and unashamed, as opposed to covered in fig leaves and trying to dispel your shame on your own. And the beautiful thing about restoration is that what God restores becomes more beautiful and more glorious, not despite the sin or having been ruined, but because of it. And that's an amazing idea. So if you've got a 500-year-old violin that is, I don't know, Stradivarius might only be 100 years old, but let's say it's the most expensive, precious, beautiful violin in the world. If it were smashed and then restored as an exact replica, it would actually be more valuable and very likely have a richness to it. And then the story becomes more profound because of how it was ruined and restored. And that's what God does with restoration. In the New Testament, restoration is used in the story of the Gospels, where the fishermen are repairing the nets that have been torn from overuse. And in some cases, because the nets got too full. And when they mend or restore the nets, the part of the net that has been broken, torn, and restored, it's actually stronger in that place than if it had never been broken by the way that it's mended. And therefore, the currency, the transaction that occurs in the relationship between the accountability partner and the person who's the addict, but also between God, is it's not just disclosure, as in cop accountability. It's not just putting in more effort, as in coach accountability, but it's the idea of brokenness, that there's not a coming and saying, I'm going to try really hard to be a good cardiology patient and to do this addiction recovery right. It's coming with the sense of I'm broken. I've got nothing. I've got no game. I am poor in spirit. I've tried everything. And so this relationship is going to have to be the healing agent, and to say, and to have that posture with God as well, where the posture is really simply being attentive to what's happening in the heart and being attentive to what's happening in that relationship. And the human relationship of the cardiologist goes from, as we said at the top of the podcast, accountability, where, you know, it's all about paying your mortgage, to accessing the inner world of the addict, but the addict gets to access the inner world of the person that they're sitting with. In other words, for example, the accountability cardiologist can share what's happening inside of them at any given time. So let's say that the addict comes and says, you know, today I've had a hard week. Maybe I'm still sober. Maybe I'm not, but I'm just feeling a lot of shame and weariness. And the person sitting with them speaks out of their own experience and says, well, can I share what it's like to be with you today? And sure, yeah, you can do that. And the addict is expecting to hear, you know, you're disappointed in me, or you're frustrated that I'm not making better progress. And out of this accessibility to their own heart, because they've got nothing to prove, they don't have to be an expert to achieve a certain result, they just say, you know, it's delightful to be with you. I just love your heart to keep showing up here and trusting that God is doing something. And there again, that's not a magic sentence that if somebody is listening to this should write that down and say it, but it's a real relationship that comes in real time out of the connection of the two people. Brian, what I'd like to do is to read some questions that will be examples of what a cardiologist accountability partner can ask. And I think this is going to drive home the point that this is not about being a professional psychotherapist. It's just about being curious and paying attention. Do we have time for that?
Yeah, I think we definitely have time for that. And as we wrap up here, we'll conclude with these questions. You know, one of my favorite books over the last couple of years was written by Simon Sinek called Start With Why. And one thing I love about the cardiologist accountability is the essence of, or the motivation for it, is founded in love. And, you know, the greatest thing that we can do for our brother and our sister is to love on them. And so I am particularly fond of this this episode, and hopefully one that I'm going to listen to in the future to understand really the essence of cardiologist accountability. So, Michael, what are some of those questions as we conclude today's episode?
Yeah, one question would be, and this is interesting because you said the book was about why, a question that I find is rarely asked, and I've done this ever since the earliest days of counseling, where you simply ask the question, why do you think you struggle with pornography and lust or with sex? And I think Christians sometimes bypass that question because Paul says in Romans 7, why do I do what I don't want to do, and why do I not do what I want to do? He's asking that question, and there's no answer, at least in that chapter. So it's kind of like, well, that's pointless to ask. Apparently, I'm just a sinner, because I'm a sinner is the answer to every question like that. But stop and think about it. If you're listening to this podcast, maybe you want to hit pause and just ask yourself the question with any compulsion or addiction. Maybe you've never struggled with sex, but with eating, or with anger, or with shopping, or with people pleasing, or workaholism. Why do I think I struggle with this? And the importance is less the answer than to help a person understand, I really don't have clarity about that. And there's very few places we can go to get clarity about our inner world, because in the Christian community, unfortunately, we've tended to default to do something. You know, if you're feeling depressed, just get happy. If you're struggling with an addiction, just say no and resist temptation or get accountability. But when we can have the clarity of, oh, I'm doing this because there's a legitimate God-given need in me for comfort or for a sense of safety. And because of my background, because of my story, it's terrifying to me. And I have panic attacks when I think of asking a person out on a date, or when a husband thinks about sitting and sharing about his inadequacy with his wife. And so the default is, well, I'll go get that need met without being vulnerable and trusting another. So this is a big question. Another question is, on a scale of 1 to 10, and I'm not a big fan of 1 to 10 scale questions, but on a scale of 1 to 10, how self-aware do you think you are? If 10 is the most self-aware person in the world, and 1 is your autistic and nonverbal, then what number? And why do you think that? And see, it just opens up questions. The person might say, oh, well, in my family, nobody was self-aware, and we never talked about our feelings. Boom. You're into their story, and you're into family of origin and relationships. I posed this question in Surfing for God, but it's such an important question. Where do you feel most alive as a man? Or in the case of a woman, where do you feel most alive as a woman? And oftentimes people will say, I don't really feel alive anywhere. And as I discussed this in the book, I said that at the time, 20 plus years of counseling, I had never heard a man say, oh, that's easy. I feel most alive when I'm around my wife. Why? Because in that relationship of great vulnerability, but also potentially great impact, a man can feel exposed and shamed in a way that few other situations will bring about that shame. So men, we typically feel competent and alive and strong at work or in our hobby or maybe even in parenting. So that question exposes something in the heart. Where do you feel most inadequate as a man or as a woman? And that's kind of flipping the question over. Asking the question, what do you think brings about change? 3 years ago, my friend Brad invited me to speak at the Navigators, and I did a two-day workshop, and I said, what do you want me to talk about? And he said, anything you want. And I said, how about if I talk about how people change? And it was one of the funnest trainings I ever did, because we just started with a blank slate, and we started the day basically saying to everyone, so how do you think people change? You know, and some people would say, well, we just need to set goals and accomplish them. And others would say we need to identify our cognitive distortions. And, you know, spiritually speaking, as well as just human development, that's a really important question. Another question, what is at stake for you as you pursue a woman in your life, whether it's a spouse, a girlfriend, fiance? What is at stake if you're not in a relationship, of pursuing a relationship that really matters to your heart? Question like, where are you broken? Where have you been wounded? I love this question, Brian. On an average day, fill in this blank. On an average day, God feels blank with me or toward me. And I've had people just relentlessly answer that question, well, that's easy. On an average day, God feels disappointed with me or toward me, or God feels frustrated with me or toward me. What is your definition of spirituality? That's another question. I quote this frequently. Ronald Rollheiser said that Christian spirituality is about what we do with the restlessness in our soul. Another question, on a scale of 1 to 10, how aware of you? On a scale of 1 to 10, how aware are you of your desires? What are the desires or longings that you have in your heart? King David, the man after God's own heart, was acutely aware of his longings. Psalm 38, it says, all my longings lie open before you, God. My sighing is not hidden from you. Another question, when was the last time that you just sat still and did nothing? I often say that for a sex addict or a porn addict or the sexual compulsive, that the most difficult command in the Bible to obey has nothing to do with sexual obedience or what we often call sexual purity. It has to do with be still and know that I'm God. Because sometimes at that moment of temptation, we need to press into the loneliness, which oftentimes involves building up the skill and the capacity to do that in relationship. Another question, have you ever felt lonely in a crowd or among other people? When do you feel the most lonely? How do you handle stress in your life? Other than sexual sin, where else have you felt failure or where you couldn't fix yourself? Describe three friends and what those relationships are like. How do you define friendship? And here's one that's seemingly unrelated to pornography. Who are the heroes in your life and why them? I think we all long to have heroes and just people that we want to be like, people that there's certain parts of their life which awaken something inside of us. And the person with sexual compulsion and addiction believes that their desires and their longings are the enemy to be managed, to be suppressed. And the idea of heroes is, I want to be like that. So Eugene Peterson was a hero of mine while he was alive and still is and always will be. And there was a sense of 25, 30 years ago, I read his book, The Contemplative Pastor, and I found this line, and I highlighted it, and I typed it out on a piece of paper, and it said something along the lines of, a very original and spiritual man must shape his life in a way where, and this is where I'm paraphrasing, you have large spaces of time to think and create and just be still. And it's that image of Eugene and seeing his life and seeing how prolific he was that I saw out on the horizon, that I've tried to grow into that. And I'm far from that. But heroes awaken desire inside of us. Bruce Springsteen, who we've talked about on the podcast before, and this might be really silly, but as a blue-collar kid from Cleveland, I want to be 72 years old and as creative and hardworking and alive and self-deprecating, but honoring at the same time and aware of how lucky I am to have family and people around me that love me. Now, people might go, well, that's weird. Why him? Well, that's all related to my story. But there's something about the concert that I saw him do that had 1,700 people. Wasn't a concert, actually. It was a stage play. 1,700 people going from laughter to tears to shouting out amen as he closed this Tony Award-winning play with the Lord's Prayer. And at the end, I just turned to my friend and I said, I want to be like Bruce when I grow up. Not a rock star, but a man who has been at the height of fame and had to encounter his own humanity and brokenness and depression and father wound, growing up with a father with mental illness, and just has become an extraordinary human being and person. And everybody has a version of that. It might be, for some, a parent. I can't relate to that, but my hero is my mom or dad. That awakens and inspires us to be something other than we are. And so cardiologist accountability is about getting access to the heart of the other. It's about the addict giving access. And where this is in scripture, it's a good point to end on, is in the old, old story in Genesis chapter 3, Adam and Eve take the fruit. Their eyes are open because now they know about good and evil. And they see that they're naked and they cover themselves with fig leaves. And God shows up. Where are you? But when he says, Adam, where are you? As I've said before on the podcast, God knew where Adam was. It's that Adam didn't know where he was. And when God shows up like that, searching for, looking for, coming for Adam, God doesn't have his glasses down on the end of his nose like a British schoolmaster saying, Adam, I can't believe you did that. You should know better. He comes with the sense of, will you give me access? Will you let me in? Will you take off the fig leaves and let me see you? And even when there's defensiveness and covering and then hiding in the trees and Adam blaming the woman and then blaming God, you know, you are the one that put her here with me, so it's kind of your fault. God does this gracious thing. And it's saying, whether you give me access or not, I'm giving you grace. And hopefully that grace will woo you to learn to trust and to be vulnerable. And the scriptures tell us that God makes garments of skin for Adam and Eve. And it's as if he's saying, you think that you can cover your shame, and you can't cover your shame because it's actually an illusion. And I see the real you, and I want you to cover yourself with something that's a gift from me. And all of that is a foreshadowing of how in Isaiah and then in the epistles, there's this rich imagery of being clothed in righteousness by God, that we can't grasp righteousness. We can't cover ourselves to make ourselves right, but we can clothe ourselves with the righteousness and the goodness and the kindness and the beauty that comes from the Lord. And as we experience even small tastes of that by sitting as we really are in the presence of people who see us and love us, that then gives us greater and greater confidence to open our hearts, to let others have access to us. And as we feel that safety and that security, there's even that sense of neuropathways being rewired and our central nervous system coming back down into a place of groundedness and centeredness instead of reactivity. And that's the life where a person is not just sober, where they're not just recovering, but where it's really a life restored to be able to be at peace and to be anxious about nothing. And that's the life of freedom. And those are some thoughts on accountability and why we always ought to be working toward the deepest kind of intimacy.
So we've wrapped up another episode of Restoring the Soul. We want you to know that Restoring the Soul is so much more than a podcast. In fact, the heart of what we have done for nearly 20 years is intensive counseling. When you can't wait months or years to get out of the rut you're in, our intensive counseling programs in Colorado allow you to experience deep change in half-day blocks over 2 weeks. To learn more, visit RestoringTheSoul.com. That's RestoringTheSoul.com.
You already know we live in a pornified world, but most of us are at a loss for how to navigate this sea of temptation. It's either ceaseless striving on the one hand or giving in to brokenness on the other. But doesn't the gospel offer us another way? The truth is that our sexual struggles are not actually about sex, but about a misdirected, God-given longing for deep connection. Dig deeper in my book, Surfing for God, Discovering the Divine Desire Beneath Sexual Struggle.